listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
This past weekend, an independent and nonpartisan group of women held the Women's March on the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. Cindy Sheehan and Bonnie Caracciola were the two chief organizers of a march endorsed by at least a dozen organizations, including the Green Party of the United States, UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, and the Black Alliance for Peace. Washington, D.C.'s Radio Sputnik caught up with Sheehan and Caracciola on Friday. The two organizers spoke with Radio Sputnik's Loud and Clear host Brian Becker and John Kiriakou. This was Brian Becker.
Cindy Sheehan, you were telling Bonnie as we started that this is the first time we met, but that's not true.
No, that's not true.
We've been at countless activities together for a long time.
Yes.
And I think that I know you, but I want to make sure our audience knows you, and people may be turning on this radio today at 105.5 FM and really not know about your own, well, legendary role in terms of helping to catalyze and stimulate and keep an anti-war movement going in the United States. Talk about how you got involved.
In April of 2004, as a matter of fact, April 4th, 2004, my son, Casey Sheehan, was in the U.S. military in the 1st Cavalry, and he was just barely in Iraq for about a week, and he was killed in combat. And even though, and he was a Humvee mechanic that was promised by his recruiter that he would never see combat. And, you know, I hear that that's a very common lie that recruiters tell our young people. But anyway, we were against the war before. After Casey was killed, I was fired from my job because I had to take too much time off. And this is the compassionate support the troops, support their families, country that we live in. And but that was kind of a good thing that I got fired, because then I was able to reach out to make connections and You were one of the early connections that I was able to make. And I founded Gold Star Families for Peace at the beginning of 05. And then by August of 2005, we had started a peace camp in front of George Bush's Crawford, Texas ranch. And it was named after my son. It was called Camp Casey. And so then at that point, I was told that I had reignited the anti-war movement that kind of went dead after the massive protests on February 15th of 2003. There was millions of people around the world that said no invasion of Iraq. But after the invasion happened, as you know, Brian and Bonnie, a lot of people in the anti-war movement said, well, now we didn't want the invasion, but now that the U.S. invaded, we have to support the troops. We have to support the mission. And so then in August of 05, a lot of people came to Camp Casey, thousands. There were thousands of people around the world in solidarity doing camps, doing protests with us. And you know, in September of 05, we had a really large anti-war demo here in Washington, D.C.
September 24th, 2005, 350,000 people.
Right. And I think that was like the pinnacle, right? And then the anti-war movement, I found out, was more anti-Bush than anti-war. And so when the Democrats came back into power in 06 in the election, and then they took control of the House of Representatives with Nancy Pelosi being the House Speaker, that's when the movement really started to tank. And with the election of Obama and Obama's spread of imperialism to like at least six or seven more countries than Bush was even in, the movement was kind of dormant, although we tried to do many things in Washington, D.C. And so a lot of people have contacted me through this Women's March on the Pentagon saying, wow, thank you for reinvigorating the anti-war movement. I'm like, well, yeah, every 13 years, whether it needs it or not, I'm going to try to reinvigorate this anti-war movement. But Bonnie and I have been very strict. We're saying this is not an anti-Trump thing. This is an anti-U.S. militarism thing. This is an anti-imperial thing. We're against the war machine, no matter who's in charge of it. So we've been trying to keep Trump out of it. And I think we've been pretty sick. Not that we're Trump supporters, but I think we've been really successful.
Yeah, that's the voice of Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan is a longtime anti-war leader, organizer, activist. Her son, Casey, killed during the Iraq War. We're also joined in studio by Bonnie Caracciolo.
Perfect.
I said it perfect, right? I'm getting better. Bonnie, obviously what you're doing this Sunday is both commemorative in one sense, because it's an anniversary. I want you to talk about that and the timing of this. But it's not simply a matter of looking backwards. You, both of you, and the people organizing this are looking forward, because we need to look forward. We need to fight back. Talk about the anniversary, why you picked this date, and what your real goals are with the demonstration.
Well, we are actually honoring the memory of those who marched on the Pentagon on October 21st, 1967. And mostly they were, it was during the Vietnam War, and the 67 was a very bad year. Not that the 20 years of the Vietnam War, well, the American War, which is what the Vietnamese call it appropriately. So they marched on the Pentagon. It was a huge merging. There was actually a concert that day being presented by Phil Oakes at the West Pentagon Park, nearby this of anti-war movement that was organizing. I think there ended up being about 70,000 people. It's gone from 50 to 70, but you know how that happens over the years. At any rate, this was the infamous march where they applied for a permit to levitate the Pentagon.
That was the Yippies.
The Yippies,
the
yeah.
Yippie wing of the anti-war movement
the
wanted
Yippie
to levitate.
Wing, which was really more street theater kind of thing. And they did some awesome stuff. I mean, there's no question about it. I'm sure you can look online and find all kinds of great stuff about that particular day. But anyway, they even applied for a permit and put in there that they wanted to levitate.
I've seen that permit application.
300 feet. And somebody with a sense of humor in the Pentagon scratched out 300 and said, you can only levitate it 3 feet. So good luck with that.
Well, they tried to do something because those demonstrators were very determined.
They
and
were.
When they got to the doors of the Pentagon, there was a clash.
There was a clash. There were people hurt. They were confronted with military men with drawn bayonets. And it got pretty ugly. Some people were conked on the head and arrested. And so it went. But the fact is they did accomplish it. And I think something like a dozen people actually got through the door.
That's right.
Into the Pentagon itself.
Where they were beaten and sort of tortured, actually.
Yeah, they were kicked in the head and thrown around the room and so forth. And that was to be expected, I guess. Although I'll tell you honestly, back in those days, that was a lot more unusual than usual. It got worse in 68 at the Democratic Convention, as we all know. But at any rate, that's what we're doing. We're honoring the memory of that event. And also the Women's March on the Pentagon that happened in 1982. Also the same. Was it the same day? Was it October? It was a different time. So, which isn't to say that we're being very original here in that respect. You know, we're standing, as they say, on the shoulders of giants. We believe that the military budget currently in the United States is obscene. What it does is obscene. We all know that. And how we're looking into the future is to just get the conversation going. Americans have a way of looking away. You can show them pictures of starving people in Yemen. You can show them video of nurses and other non-combatants in Gaza being shot point blank in the face, having their legs blown off and so forth. But they can look away from that and say, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to see it. Well, you better listen and you better watch because it's not going to get any smaller. We're currently looking at 60 cents of every dollar of our budget, our collective budget, our hands are all in it, goes to the military. The wastefulness is already horrific enough, never mind the killing and torture and the devastation of the environment. But the abuses and shortfalls in the budget, where just last week they announced, or it might have been this week, was announced that the entire F-35 fleet has been grounded because of flaws. These are jets that cost, I don't know, $5 million a piece?
No.
$5 billion a piece?
Hundreds of millions.
Hundreds of millions.
Per plane.
Bernie's boondoggle?
Yeah, Bernie's boondoggle.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. I'm glad you mentioned the F-35. One mm-hmm. of the things that the Pentagon did cleverly and obviously is they made the subcontracting for the F-35, a plane that has, you know, it doesn't actually work militarily, but it's a big source of funds. The subcontracting is done in 46 out of the 50 states.
Yep.
And as a consequence, every congressional district sort of has a dog in the F-35 fight, whether it works or not. That's the military
right.
industrial congressional complex.
Absolutely.
that's dominating the country. Cindy Sheehan, let me ask you, why a women's march? There was a women's march, right? The first or the second day of the Trump administration, huge demonstration. This is a women's march, too. Obviously, you're inviting men and women.
And everybody. Yeah.
And everyone. Mm-hmm. But why a women's march?
Okay, so there was a big women's march, a couple days after the inauguration. But then there was one on the anniversary of that march also. And so they, this year, you know, the first year, my sister died on that day, and I, you know, she was in my house. She died in my arms. Dee Dee Miller, a great peace activist that a lot of people know or knew. And so the next year, I had time to check out the Women's March platform. And the first year, I kind of thought the pink hats were ridiculous. But the second year, when I was looking at their platform, it didn't address war. It didn't address war, imperialism. And I said, war is a women's issue. I reached out to them. I said, why isn't war addressed in your demands, your website, or whatever? And this is verbatim what they told me, Brian. Cindy, we appreciate war is your issue, but we will never address that issue as long as women aren't free. And what they really meant was as long as white, Democrat, privileged women aren't free from Trump. That's what they want. They want to be free from Trump. So I thought we needed an internationalist movement that cared about all the women in the world, even all the women here in the United States. How many, even even though like the Women's March tried to be really inclusive, how many women felt left out of that? Poor women, women of color, disadvantaged women, women in the inner cities felt left out of the Women's March. So a friend of mine said, we should do a, she's on KPFA in Berkeley. She said, why don't we do a spoof and we'll call, we'll say we're calling for a Women's March on the Pentagon on the 51st anniversary of the March on the Pentagon. And I was like, spoof, why don't we organize one? And so we're calling it Women's March because we recognize that women are harmed the most by war. 80% of casualties are women and their children now. The economics devastation of their communities, their countries, their way of life really falls really hard on the woman. And we have a thing at our website, marchonpentagon.com, that shows that women are, we prove that women are most detrimentally affected by war. So, but we're an internationalist movement in solidarity with all oppressed women, occupied women, and their families and communities around the world. We're not a chauvinistic bougie march.
That's Cindy Sheehan. Bonnie, the Department of Defense budget was increased in the last year by $64.6 billion. Now, just again, for our audience that might not understand, because none of us know what a billion is or a trillion, it's just too much money, right? But $64 billion increase in 1 year is greater than Russia's entire military budget. It's greater. It's about one-fifth of China's entire military budget. The United States spends 10 times more than Russia on defense spending. It spends 5 times more than China. It spends more than the next 8 countries or 10 countries combined. The U.S. has 1,000 military bases in 140 countries around the world. That's most countries. The last time the U.S. mainland was invaded was the War of 1812, and we can do the math on that. That was 206 years ago. So why? Why is it that the United States has this not only expanding military budget, but expanding so exponentially that it's greater than the countries that it identifies as its main, quote, enemies? Why?
Well, because all wars are economic. And basically, I mean, if you look at those countries you mentioned, they also all have universal health care, for example. The economics of war are pretty obvious when you start pulling it apart. You know, Cindy mentioned the fact that something like what, or one of you did, the 43 or 47 states have a dog in the fight, if you will. And that's premeditated because as long as you've got a state's economy relying on some facet of the military, whether it's providing for an installation or a manufacturer. I had a friend who worked for a company called Force Protection down in South Carolina. And what they did, and they made tons of money, what they did was they rewired MRAPs, which are those big giant military vehicles for, you know, they'd upgrade the computers and so forth. So they made a ton of money on that. South Carolina, being the kind of state it is, also brought Boeing in. But they fought about it because they didn't want to have unions, and Boeing is a union shop. So there was a big fight, but of course, Boeing won, or South Carolina won. The point I'm getting at is that war is for profit, and you can't have and conduct wars and manufacture these things and support this economy without actually having war. So, you know, there's no civil war in anywhere in the world that the United States doesn't love. Because we're going to go in and fix it. And I put big fat quotes around the fix it part. Part of that is our interference involves supplying weaponry in every kind of shape and form, from tear gas canisters to Tomahawk missiles and even ships and all that stuff. So really, it's a matter of money. I mean, it's a for-profit endeavor. And why do you know, how can you make money if there's no war?
And the other thing is that these military goods are commodities of a particular, special, different, distinctive kind, because unlike all other commodities that human beings can actually use in one way or the other, these can only be used in war, and they can only be replenished when they're destroyed in war. So it's a commodity unlike any other commodity in the capitalist marketplace. And in fact, it's exempt from the capitalist marketplace because the contractors, these big corporations, you mentioned Lockheed Martin or Northrop Grumman, they're given guaranteed profit plus contracts. So it's this huge scam, it seems to me. But, you know, if you told the people of the United States, look, you don't have money for housing and education and healthcare and things, human beings, things that you might actually need, but we have to spend all of this money. If you tell them it's really just so rich people can get ever richer, people are going to say, no, that doesn't make sense. So we have national security.
Right.
We have defense.
Right.
And what you mentioned, Cindy, is so poignant, that the same media and governmental outlets talk so much like they love the soldiers. They love their families. But the bottom line is they don't give a damn about them, actually. They're just really a prop. They're a prop.
Absolutely.
In order to justify this kind of theft from the national treasury.
Right.
Anyway, that's the way I see it.
Well, also, that's true. That's the way it is. But didn't Trump just say we couldn't really hold Saudi Arabia accountable for the Khashoggi thing because we want to sell them $105 billion in weapons? That just proves that what the United States is just a weapons seller, in a drug, black market, white market, weapons, drugs, whatever. And that's what our economy is about. And it's a pitiful economy. Not only, Brian was talking about the F-35 and how many congressional districts, but every congressional district, there's some kind of industry that employs people. And so it's like this big cancerous octopus that has its tentacles everywhere, and it would be so hard to extricate. And here in Washington, D.C., most of the people coming to our protests will not be from Washington, D.C. I think, what would be your guess, 90% of the people work for the government or the military-industrial complex?
Well, it's actually about 50%, but then when you get to people who are, let's say, you don't work for the government, but you're in a restaurant that's serving
right.
government workers. So
yeah,
when
yeah.
you get through the ripple effect, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
It's all supportive of the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, and it's also become very affluent, this area, since September 11th, because so much money has poured into the military. Bonnie, you know, one thing that we're talking about, Cindy mentioned what Trump said, well, doesn't matter what the Saudis do against Khashoggi or Yemen, we have to sell them these weapons, it's $110 billion. But the $110 billion, and this is something that Democrats don't mention, is the exact same number that Obama allowed the Saudis to buy, or insisted that the Saudis buy, during the 8 years of the Obama administration. That was also $110 billion of
wow.
arms sales to Saudi.
Mm.
So a lot of people say, look at Trump, he doesn't care. But the Democrats, the Republicans, are identical. I'm not even being hyperbolic. They are identical on these kind of issues.
I couldn't agree more. As a matter of fact, I think then when Trump presented his initial military budget here in the last year or so, that the Democrats even threw some in. Didn't they?
Yeah,
like,
oh,
that
yeah,
wasn't
they expanded
enough.
It.
Yeah,
that's
they expanded
$65 billion more dollars.
Have another $65 billion.
Yeah.
What the heck?
Yeah.
You know, what? Why
we
nitpick?
We laugh, but
yeah.
it's just.
Why nitpick? So it's gotten to where, and with something like this that's so out of control, And you know, they haven't turned, and by the way, the Pentagon has not turned in a budget for 17 years, not a penny. They haven't accounted for a dime that's gone in or gone out. They keep saying, you know, we're putting one together, you know, just wait, you know, we'll get it together pretty soon. But, you know, 17 years later, we still haven't seen anything. And meanwhile, they keep losing money. Like, what was the last figure, 21 million or 21 billion that
yeah.
they was unaccounted
well,
for?
They lost a couple billion that they brought in stacks of $100 bills on great
pallets,
big pallets
yeah.
into Iraq, and they can't find that
and
money.
And they can't find
it's
that.
Somewhere. I just, we just can't
billion
find
dollars.
It.
Yeah.
Right,
I just
right.
misplaced
Where's
it.
Where's Waldo?
$5,000.
So anyway, I mean, the good thing that's coming out is hopefully is that the word is out. Thanks to people like you, some of us are getting the information. Unfortunately, as we all know, what I don't even call it mainstream anymore, because there's nothing mainstream about it. It's corporate media.
Exactly.
All of this is tied in. You know, they're telling us what they want us to believe, and people are believing it. So they're like, hey, everything's great. You know, it's the bad guys are the Republicans and the good guys are the Democrats. And this we've always kind of been a nation of black and white.
Yeah. Let's talk about what's actually going to happen this weekend. We have about 2.5 minutes left. There's events Saturday from 12 p.m. to 9 p.m. at St. Stephen's Church in the sort of Mount Pleasant, Adams Morgan area. And then Sunday, what time does it start? Where should people go?
Well, people should really go to marchonpentagon.com and to find the specifics. But we're meeting at 11 or before. You know, we're starting to gather at the Pentagon City. Pentagon City, not the Pentagon Metro Stop, but Pentagon City Metro Stop. We're going to march to the Pentagon. Our rally is from 1 to 4, and we have many great speakers and musicians. And Brian, you and I, like we said, have worked together for a long time. I think this is going to be the most exciting event in 10 years, at least, since Obama's been president and on. But also, we're moving forward. This is going to be a movement where we want to have a loose coalition of anti-imperialist forces that recognize that the Democrats and the Republicans, are, like you said, are exactly the same, especially on the issue of imperialism.
And that's important, Bonnie. We have 1 minute left. Not just anti-war, which might suggest that the problem with war is it's the absence of peace, but it's also the absence of justice, because in this case, we're talking about imperialism. How do you see that in our last minute? I mean, why is the U.S. war drive an imperialist war drive?
Well, because it's about money. Again, as I say, all wars are economic, and the recruitment of minorities and poor people is over the top. You know, as Jean-Paul Sartre said, the rich wage war and the poor die.
That was Bonnie Caracciola, co-organizer with Cindy Sheehan of this past weekend's Women's March on the Pentagon, speaking with Radio Sputnik's Loud and Clear host, Brian Becker, this past Friday about the march. We have some sound from Sunday's march, which we will bring you now.
So thank you, everybody, for being here. Right now, I feel like I want to say that I'm marching today for my son Casey, who was killed in Iraq, and for my sister Dee Dee, who died from breast cancer last year, because she would be here if she could. I want everybody to take like 10 seconds. Think of your mother, your sister, your aunt, whomever, who was a strong advocate for peace and who would be here. Think of the women in all the countries that the U.S. is currently bombing and occupying. Yeah. Think about the poor, oppressed women in our own country that we march for. I'm going to count down from 5 and yell out the name of the person you're marching for today. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Gracie!
Thank you, everybody. So now, I'm going to introduce the grand poobah of our march, Malachi Kilbride. You'll notice he's not a woman, but you might observe that when he comes up. But he has been helping us here in Washington, D.C. Very much with this march. Malachi's a person, when I have anything here, he's always on board. And then Howell from Chelsea United Against the War is going to translate it into Spanish, because we want everybody here to feel welcome. So there you go. And then after that, Malachi will tell us how to line up and stuff for the, he'll give us the logistics for the march.
Thank you, Cindy. Yes, so I'm here to welcome you. So welcome. I've lived in the D.C. area for a long time. I just recently moved to Baltimore, but welcome. It's really good to see this turnout here today. I'm very much aware that on the face of things, we all had a choice to be here today. We didn't have to be here, but we chose to come. And I think you're like me in the sense that we could do no other. We had to be here today.
Yeah!
We know it's our responsibility to confront this war machine.
Yeah!
This march could very well likely be a turning point in the anti-war movement in the United States. And we need to make it that.
Yeah!
We cannot continue to have these wars going. And you are very much aware, as I am, that many of our fellow residents and citizens of this country are not aware that we are militarily engaged in at least 7 countries right now. We have hundreds of military bases and installations all over the planet. And we are paying for future wars and past wars, but it's the future wars we need to be very mindful of right now. This is another reason why we're marching today. Because when you pay for war, you're going to get war. And we have a responsibility to stop that. We know since 9/11 we've been lied to into this continuous cycle of wars that we must stop. Yeah! Here we are outside of the perimeter of the Pentagon. But that's not where the wars are just waged and planned. Look around us. These buildings around here have war contractors. Yeah. This is the concentration of the military-industrial complex in the United States, Arlington County. Yeah. Up the road in Roslyn, it's no different. All of those skyscrapers you see up there that aren't residences are contractors. Half the people up there are in uniform working for the Pentagon, and the other half are suits also working for the Pentagon. But it's no different. We're all immersed in this system of war making, no matter where we are in this country. And we have to put a stop to it. We have to speak out. As you know, I'm preaching to the choir right now. But today, this will be our turning point. And if we have to come back next year, we will. But we're going back to our communities to say the war machine is sucking the life out of all of us, and we must stop it. So listen, in a few moments we're going to march from here. The Pentagon is that way. This is Hayes Street, South Hayes Street. We're going to process up to Army Navy Drive. We're going to go right, and we're going to walk about a block or two to Fern Street, and we're going to go left into the Pentagon. So let's stick together. Let's be loud.
Yeah!
Let's be one community.
Nonviolent!
And nonviolent. And now, my friend, thank you.
And keep the police aware of that.
Buenas tardes, público latinoamericano.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. It's official now. Jamal Khashoggi died in the Saudi consulate in Turkey on October 2nd. The person or persons responsible for his death is yet to be determined. But one thing is certain. This tragic story is far from over. Cross-talking some real news, I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Babich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And we have Glenn Deason. He is a professor at the Higher School of Economics, as well as author of The Decay of Western Civilization and Resurgence of Russia. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want. And I always appreciate it. Glenn, in the future, we're going to do a review of your book. But we're going to stick with this Khashoggi story here. Mark, who are the winners? Who are the losers here? And where do you think this is going to go?
Well, the ultimate loser is, of course, the journalist slash intelligence affiliate Jamal Khashoggi
slash regime dissident insider.
Yeah. I mean, he's been a fervent member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Something that if you mention, you are part of the right-wing whisper smear campaign against him.
Oh, he was a real player.
He was a real player. He was involved with the CIA and former Saudi intelligence. He was opposed to the most recent. He was the protege of the former intelligence official of Saudi Arabia, the head of their intelligence. And since the Saudi Arabia's fallout with the Muslim Brotherhood during the Arab Spring, spring, he has since been excised from power and became an actual dissident against the Saudi government. He was also affiliated with the CIA. Obviously, the U.S. is losing here. Israel doesn't want to see him go. The big beneficiaries that I see are Turkey, which is in a type of rivalry for neo-Ottoman influence in the Arab world with Saudi Arabia. It's kind of the non-monarchist political Islamists, Turkey, the Muslim Brotherhood, against the Wahhabist absolutists. And also, by being de facto allied with Turkey now against Saudi Arabia, Qatar benefits. Qatar. And I think you could say that Russia and Iran are sitting in the backward laughing.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with Mark that Turkey would be probably the biggest winner so far. And yeah, they've been stumbling around for the last couple of years and making mistake after mistake. But in this instance, I think they've played their cards quite well.
And improved relations with the United States in the process, one could say, the release of that pastor.
Yes, indeed. But I guess, but at the same time, putting the United States in a bit of a difficult position, though, as they deliberately began leaking this quite slowly and, you know, first giving enough time for the Saudis to deny that.
Drip.
Yeah, so exactly. First, giving enough time for the Saudis to say that. No, he actually left the consulate and then leaving enough time for Trump to say, no, we definitely believe the Saudis. And then the next information comes out where they actually leak say that they have the audio tapes, and now the Saudi has to change their story. Trump has to tell again that, I believe their news story as well.
So Erdogan is pulling everyone by their noses with this narrative here. Dima, but this isn't over yet, all right, because there are a lot of players. I mean, it's also become a domestic issue to some degree in the United States, where you have members of Congress that just because they're opposed to Donald Trump are going to take a hard line on Saudi Arabia here. Go ahead.
Well, let's remind our viewers that actually the cooperation between the United States and Saudi regime started a lot earlier than Donald Trump came to power. Obama pumped money and arms into Saudi Arabia for years.
Well, I mean, ever since the Second World War.
If you ask me who is the winner, our understanding of the Western system and of its ability to ally itself with thugs and murderers, our understanding is the winner. Because actually, I just love this explanation that Trump bought. Khashoggi entered the consulate and he got into a brawl, into a kind of a
against
conflict.
15 guys, right?
Including three of Mohammed bin Salman's bodyguards.
You know
who
what
just
it reminded me
there.
Of? During the Maidan, demonstrations, which were in fact a coup d'etat, three American ambassadors wrote a letter to the New York Times writing, keeping in mind that Mr. Yanukovych used truncheons, no wonder that the demonstrators got a little impatient. They forgot to add that these impatient demonstrators killed 32 policemen, right? And later on, they called it a peaceful transfer of power.
I think you have a good point, our understanding of how it works. I think that's a really good point here. Mark, but I think never before has been there so much spotlight on Saudi Arabia. They don't like it. I've always said in American media, say very little about Israel and never say anything about Saudi Arabia. Now they're talking about it a lot.
The other big loser out of all of this is the Western mainstream media hacks and the think tanks that are funded by Saudi Arabia that dominate Washington. For starting in the Obama and the end of the Obama administration and moving in today, the Western mainstream media has gushed about the liberal reformer Mohammed bin Salman. I think Thomas Friedman was literally in love with him and wanted to take him out on a date.
He's sticking by his interview. It's amazing.
And now, not one of them can really admit that they were wrong in their servile, whitewashing of Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. I mean, we're talking about a country that regularly behead people like every day. They cut the heads off of women they claim are witches and dissidents all over the place. They conduct assassinations of dissidents all over the world. And we're suddenly going to act shocked because they chopped up
The interesting thing for me, Glenn, is that, I on this program, we have talked about the nature of the Saudi regime quite openly and regularly, particularly
briefly when we were discussing Syria over the last years. But it seems that only belatedly, because Saudi Arabia is in the spotlight, the people are beginning to talk a little bit more about Yemen, which we've profiled very often here. You know, it finally took this internal squabble.
I think that's a good way to characterize it. Saudi intelligence. I think fighting amongst themselves.
And then we'll wait for the purge. Yeah. Okay. And who's going to come out on top and even stronger?
Purge,
but
yeah.
I want to keep with this Yemen issue. I mean, it is getting a little bit more of a spotlight because you were talking about Erdogan's mishaps over the years in foreign policy. Well, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, the same thing has been happening to him. In gross mishaps under his nominal rule. Go ahead.
Well, you could add Yemen to the list of possible winners there as well, given that they're...
Finally, something,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, yeah. So I think this could, well, depending on what happens at the end of all of this in Saudi Arabia, it could reduce some pressure. Because there's a lot of people moving now against Saudi Arabia within the U.S. And we talked about that before. That
Do you think it's rhetoric?
Rhetorical? No, well, it depends with some. I think, like Lindsey Graham, I think it's. I think he has to show.
Rand Paul.
Yeah, no, okay. I think he's much more authentic.
That's authoritative.
It was a big popcorn moment for me to hear Lindsey Graham say that he wants to sanction the hell out of Saudi Arabia. I was like, wow, neocon versus Wahhabi. Game on.
Well, I mean, let me quote this article by Thomas Friedman about the Saudi Arab Spring.
Please don't.
No, I will do it. Because Thomas Friedman, this is political
pornography, but go ahead, Dima.
Thomas Friedman was worn out by a firing hose of ideas, reformist ideas, coming from a leader of an Arab state. So he couldn't stand it for more than 12 hours in a wigwam with Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He said, let me just quote it again, "You should be a fool to trust this prince, but you should be a fool not to root for him." Okay, he rooted for him because, as he wrote then, women would be driving. Yes, women would be driving, and he would be killing. And this is exactly what Thomas Friedman was rooting for in his articles.
MBS, what is his future? He's wounded. What's going to happen?
Well, I guess the best decision for the Saudi family would be to get rid of him and essentially make him the fall guy here, because so far they try to get rid of a couple of top officials and, you know, brush the whole issue under the rug. So I don't think that's going to happen. So at the end of the day, it depends how much, whether or not they're able to or willing to push him aside.
But the Lindsey Graham thing I thought was kind of interesting because the American intelligence community had other candidates.
Yeah.
And I think that, and Lindsey, you know, I think Tucker Carlson said the new and improved Lindsey Graham vis-a-vis the Kavanaugh hearings. But now Lindsey's back with his neocon ideas. And I think it's not because of the tragedy in the Saudi consulate. It's because of something else. Yeah, clumsy, exactly.
They're embarrassed by now their relationship with Saudi Arabia. And that's what's bothering them more than the death of a Khashoggi. I think they would be happy to see Mohammed bin Salman replaced with Mohammed bin Nayef, the former crown prince, who was the kind of the CIA's man in Saudi
John
Arabia.
John Brennan openly said that he wanted him
they
back.
They wanted him. You know. Well, you know, John Brennan, the voice of the deep state.
Don't mention that man's name here.
But I think that if the king sticks by his guns and refuses to remove his son, then they will quietly be papered it over. I don't expect U.S. support in Yemen to decrease. I don't expect U.S. or European arms sales to decrease. I do expect the fury from the Washington press corps to increase, though, because why they are so outraged the way they weren't about Yemen and they weren't about everything else. It's one of theirs. He was one of theirs, and he has paid the price for being included in that circle, and that is the course of their fury. We had some
11, 12 journalists and media workers killed in post-Maidan Putsch Ukraine. Not a word said about them because they weren't their journalists.
20 seconds, Steve.
Well, I don't expect any reaction, any substantial action against Mohammed bin Salman because we have a precedent. Mikhail Saakashvili, the former president of Georgia, this week he was accused with proof by the Georgian prosecutor's office of having masterminded the killing of his political opponent, Badri Patrikhatsishvili, back in 2008. Before that, strangely, Zurab Zhvani, his other main political opponent, died mishandling an Iranian maid-oven.
Meaning it's just going to be swept
up. And he's still chilling with the hipsters in Brooklyn.
I couldn't find a single article on that in the Western media.
We've got to get a hard break. After our short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Glenn here. Let's finish up on the story with Saudi Arabia. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to point out that it's fun to mock Friedman for his somewhat absurd article, but this is not something new, though.
Another understatement. You're just a king of understatement.
If you look at, for example, New York Times or other publications through the decades since the 50s and 60s, they've been making apologies for, not just apologies for Saudi Arabia, but they've been also calling them reformers for 70 years now. It's gone on for a while, and they're always equally enthusiastic. And it kind of goes back to the idea that for United States, Saudi Arabia is a very important ally for many reasons. Oil, let's put that on top. But also they're an embarrassment. So you need a little bit of propaganda to bridge the difference between who they are
It really begs the question, and people have looked at authoritarian and totalitarian societies. Attempting to reform them only undoes the entire system itself here. I mean, the House of Saud is based on Wahhabism. I don't see enlightened Wahhabism or something like that. That's antithetical.
Wahhabism for the masses.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to say that they're actually reforming. I think it's a politically expedient to portray them being in the process of reforming.
The Saudi consulate is a good example of reform. Dima, 30 seconds, we're going to move on to another topic.
Let me remind our viewers that the American press actually sided with Mohammed bin Salman in March this year when Trump started talking about coming out of Syria. Remember, we're coming out of Syria very soon, very soon. Let the other people take care of it. Then the mainstream media praised Mohammed bin Salman for urging the United States to fulfill their duty and stay in Syria. So tell me who your enemy is, and I'll tell you who you are. With the enemies like Mohammed bin Salman, maybe Bashar al-Assad is not such a bad man.
What?
This is something that the mainstream media just doesn't mention. Whom did Bashar al-Assad have to fight? The people who kill their citizens in the consulates?
Very, very good point here. I want to move on here, guys. Donald Trump has just recently announced that the United States, I guess unilaterally, is going to be leaving the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, what's known as the INF here. For me, that's a very sad and depressing moment hearing that coming from the president, because we're running the non-proliferation regime that has been pushed for decades is coming rapidly to an end. I mean, what I find even more disappointing is that there is not even the overture to sit down and renegotiate it if both sides have issues with it. But no, Mark, they're just going to walk away from it. And I think John Bolton's name, fingerprints all over this.
Yeah, I mean, this is just the latest in the unraveling of Cold War rule-setting era.
Someone called it withdrawal syndrome.
I mean, the U.S. pulled unilaterally out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which has direct repercussions on Russia's position on the INF treaty today. The Conventional Armed Forces in Europe treaty and the NATO-Russia Founding Act have been ignored by the West as it moves forces closer to Russia's borders. We see New START is about to expire. And now this, let's be frank, it's likely that both countries, as they accuse each other, are in small violations of the Immediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Neither the U.S. or Russia benefited from this treaty in the modern strategic context, because countries like China, the UK, France are not excluded from having intermediate range nuclear weapons. During the Cold War, this was a treaty that protected Europe, that kept the US and Russian missiles pointed long range at each other rather than short range. It would mean the devastation of Europe. So one of the big losers out of this is actually Europe. I think it could actually be to Russia's position, if the U.S. pulls out of this, to renegotiate it and to get China and the EU countries, the UK included, whether they are or not, in a renegotiated INF treaty that might even be able to return to the issue of ballistic missile defense.
But that's not
Europe.
Even on the table. I think that's a reasonable, rational way to go, but it's
Putin
not even on the table.
Putin has said the INF treaty is, since the U.S. pulled out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty, this treaty is not so much in our interests anymore.
But it's not in Europe's interest, at least at the moment. Go ahead.
No, but that's because they didn't have the same restrictions. So, well, we can interpret this in different ways. I think for Trump, it fits within pattern of what he's been doing lately in terms of ripping up all these international agreements and saying he will negotiate better ones. But it's not all on Trump, though, because this INF treaty has been, there's been fears that's been unraveling for quite a few years. And it really dates back to Bush when in 2001 he decided to withdraw the United States from the ABM treaty. And this was, disrupted a lot, because for Russia they really needed to develop new weapons as well, because for the West or for NATO, they keep saying that the ABM treaty, now that the missile defense shield they're building is simply to, intercept these non-existent missiles from Iran. But as it's become more and more evident, it's targeting Russia. Russia needs to counter it somehow. But also these interceptive missiles can be converted into intermediate range nuclear missiles, so they can actually be used to target Russia. So Russia already warned, as Mark pointed out, already in 2007, Putin said that the INF treaty would have to be reconsidered because they can't live with it anymore, because the West essentially walked away from it.
Leaving these armed controls agreements, Dima, does that mean we're going to have a new arms race? I mean, is that the conclusion here?
It means we're
and is that what's preferable here?
We're going to have something worse. We're going to have chaos, because let me remind our viewers what the INF Treaty is. It was signed in the end of 1987 by Reagan and Gorbachev, when the Warsaw Treaty was still in existence, and no one could even dream of Latvia, Estonia, 100 kilometers from St. Petersburg, being actually hostile to Russia and having American troops on their territory, having British troops on their territory. No one could imagine that Poland would be a hostile state, because basically, let's call a spade
hosting
a spade.
American troops.
They call Russia a hostile nation. Okay, let's face it, look at the rhetoric of the Polish leaders, of the Baltic leaders. These are not simply not friends. These are basically enemies, military enemies.
And they want to build Fort
and
Trump.
And this was signed in 1987 under completely different circumstances. And now the Americans are saying Russians are doing something wrong. They are researching and developing. Well,
that's fair. That's fair game. The treaty allows that.
According to INF Treaty, you can research and develop. You just can't deploy. And the second, there are actually three arguments that Russia can use to its advantage. First, it's a new situation. No one expected Baltic countries and Poland and Romania be enemies. Second, what Glenn just said, the so-called anti-ballistic missiles can be used as intermediate-range missiles against Russia. And third, we basically have the whole system of arms control destroyed. CFE treaty is no longer valid, not because of us, but because CFE treaty was again signed when Warsaw Treaty was in existence. So Latvia, not even Latvia, it was not even mentioned. Poland and the Czech Republic and Slovakia are mentioned in CFE Treaty as allies of the Soviet Union, and which means of Russia.
Once this new START treaty expires is in 2021, I think, then there's actually no more
control.
No more nuclear control. Essentially, you can have just develop as many nuclear weapons you want, because this is the first time since 1972.
The previous arms trade, particularly when you look at the tension between the United States and Russia and the tensions yep. in Europe. This is the worst possible
we
time not to have arms control agreements.
Peter, when you said, arms race, the previous arms race was in the framework of an arms control system that, bad as it was created in the early 70s, so it was within a system. Now we have an arms race with one side 13 times richer than the other outside a system of arms control. This is much more dangerous.
Okay, I want to talk about the Mueller investigation. Seems to be wrapping up here. Mark, Mueller doesn't even... There's no assurance that his report will even be made public. He gives it to the deputy director at the FBI, at the DOJ, Rod Rosenstein. Rumor is there's nothing there, and that's what we've been saying for 17 months.
Is the Mueller investigation still going on? I hadn't even been paying any attention to it. Of course, it won't be released. The results or interim results, because I don't expect it to be closed down, won't be released till after the midterms when the Democrats are expected to take back control of the House. And I think everything will just be rejuvenated on their side then. They will relaunch new investigations.
But in a different direction.
The Mueller investigation went nowhere. They will try to find new holes to creep into against Trump, which is really what Mueller did anyway, going after Manafort's back taxes and so on.
My theory, Glenn, is that this whole thing was a charade from the beginning. It is to keep the focus away from malfeasance in the FBI and in the Department of Justice. They peddled a very different narrative here. If the Democrats come back and take over the House, all of the GOP's investigations, they'll be squashed, shut down, they'll disappear. And as Mark said, they'll find new rabbit holes to dig into. And so all of what we've seen for 17 months will just, as if it didn't happen. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think that's been the main purpose. Again, it doesn't really matter if they find anything at the end of the day, which apparently they don't. At the end of the day, simply having the allegations there, having the investigation, this has been obstructing Trump's foreign policy. And if we remember back from his campaign, he essentially was lashing out at everyone from his own party to opposition, foreign leaders. Everyone was a target except Russia, because he seemed to very much like Steve Bannon recognize that maybe they shouldn't have spoiled the opportunity to actually reach a post-Cold War agreement.
Because of cultural and civilizational issues.
So it seemed like that was one of his big push. He recognized that the Cold War is over. It's the main challenges are coming from Asia, China. And it's in America's interest to make peace with Russia. But because he was so close, he was pushing so hard this pro-Russian line, which is essentially it goes against both the Democrats and the Republicans. I think that this was going to be their main target. So essentially, he's a stooge of the Kremlin.
He's surrounded and probably become a neocon in outlook, and his campaign promises are in tatters right now. The deep state has won. That's all the time we have, gentlemen, here. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.